Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, a psychologist, or a legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I look at a clinical result and try to see the human story behind the data. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen, and how science is developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. Think of this as your official invitation to come over to the dark side. Don't worry, we have cookies, and we also have a shared love of hard science, lab techniques, and deep psychological breakdowns. I know I'm not the only one out here who stays up way too late, fascinated by the science of murder. So, let's find each other, pull up to the bench, look at the data, and learn together. Today we are discussing the science of the death penalty, specifically in the United States. It's a bit surreal to sit here as we just celebrated the 250th anniversary of a country built on the foundational promise of life and liberty, while we remain completely divided on our systemic execution pipeline that deprives its citizens of both. We touched on the Innocence Project last month. This month, I thought we could talk about the death penalty in general, using some key clinical data points from the Death Penalty Information Center and analyzing critical technical failures and how the state attempts to execute this ultimate output of the legal machine. Looking back at post-conviction DNA testing got me thinking about the entire infrastructure of capital punishment. Let's get entirely real right out of the gate. I don't have an idealistic moral objection to the death penalty. I don't carry that comforting black and white cognitive dissonance that allows people to hide behind pure sentimentality. If a human being commits an unconscionable predatory act against another life, I have zero conflict with the concept that they have permanently forfeited their right to exist in our society. For many people, it's a purely moral argument, an eye for an eye, or the belief that state murder isn't justified under any condition. Part of me is cynical. I believe in redemption and rehabilitation for those who can be reached. But most of the true monsters, people like Ted Bundy or John Wayne Gacy, aren't going to change. They would have been the first to tell you that. What I object to is the blatant fiction of justice we wrap it in. The death penalty isn't a majestic objective scale. It's a lazy, arbitrary punishment handed down to people who failed inside a system that systematically denied them the structural stability to survive in the first place. The state has built a massive multi-million-dollar irreversible execution pipeline under the cultural pretense that it's a necessary shield to protect us from an army of unrepentant monsters. But because that extreme danger is restricted to a rare, highly specific subset, the machine is vastly over-engineered for what society actually needs. As part of our baseline social contract, I firmly lean into the old legal maxim. It is better to let 10 guilty men go free than to torture one innocent person. I don't disagree with the concept of the death penalty, but I deeply disagree with society's application of it. Because the system lacks precision and equal application, it cannot accurately separate the rare permanent threat from the person who committed an unconscionable act under a specific non-replicable set of conditions. The machine treats them all the same. It takes a blunt, heavy-handed ideological hammer and smashes down on whatever data point happens to be sitting in the chair. When I say that I reject the comforting theater of our justice system, I'm not coming at this from an abstract academic perspective. My viewpoint was forged inside the actual machinery of the state long before I ever put on a military uniform or stepped up to a laboratory bench. As a child, I was removed from my home and placed in the foster care system. I'll tell you plainly, I did not thrive there. When you are a guest in someone else's house where the rules are volatile and the motivations of the operators are clouded by mixed intentions, survival becomes a guessing game. Because of that friction, I was moved into structured institutional care. I was placed in a facility directly alongside persons in need of supervision, teens and actual juvenile delinquents and criminals, people who were genuine dangers to individuals and society. I was not one of them. I was a lost kid without a support system, but I was also highly independent, detail-oriented, and hyper-focused. In an environment where the system's expected output for a child is statistical failure, where simply graduating high school is considered an anomaly, I looked at the structure around me and I treated it like a tool. I took advantage of every resource available. I was a bit wild, but I kept my eyes on the prize, building my own stability out of pure, unvarnished drive and motivation. By the time I was 17, I had stabilized my own path, lived with my grandparents, finished high school as a National Merit Scholar, completed a year of college, and enlisted in the United States Army. I entered the adult world fully shaped by institutional reality before I was legally old enough to vote. Why does that matter to this bench? Because it means I know exactly how massive bureaucracies protect their own data outputs and take the path of least resistance. I know firsthand that structure, rigidity, and efficiency are not inherently evil or oppressive. Humans can stabilize, survive, and collectively thrive under strict environmental regularity, provided the framework is complete and honest. In fact, GRU rehabilitation operates like a physical law. It's a tripod that requires three distinct unbending legs to achieve structural stability. The first leg of this tripod is the internal input, which is the individual's own capacity for motivation to better their situation. Now, let's be entirely clear. It doesn't take a textbook genius to survive the machine. Book smarts will only get you so far inside institutional walls. In the raw, day-to-day reality of that life, street smarts and unvarnished self-awareness are often far superior, highly agile tools. Street smarts allow you to read the terrain and navigate volatile human variables, Well, self-awareness keeps you grounded so you don't buy into your own lies. But neither tool functions without that core capacity for internal motivation. When we look at this through a clinical lens, we must recognize that a rare predatory subset completely lacks this piece. Psychopathology profiling using the Hare Psychopathy Checklist Revised, or PCL-R, alongside neurological imaging consistently shows structural deficits in the amygdala and prefrontal cortex of true neurobiological anomalies like Ted Bundy. They have a fixed biological variable that renders them structurally uncalibrated for change, meaning they require permanent containment. But the machine completely fails to differentiate this rare fixed neurological deficit from a fluid repairable behavior fracture caused by environmental starvation. That brings us to the second leg, which is the environmental structure itself, meaning the clean, predictable, and efficient discipline of the immediate environment. If you combine that discipline with the third leg, the external resources and tools like mental health access, educational programming, cognitive remodeling, and trade skills, you create an environment where a person can actually do the work to heal. However, our current legal system routinely chops the legs right out from under that platform. It enforces a blunt, punitive version of that environmental structure while entirely starving the system of external resources. It expects individuals to reintegrate back into society from a worse deficit than where they began. And then the operators act shocked when the machine produces a predictable cyclic failure. We build a societal pipeline that systematically starves people of the basic mechanics of survival. Fractures the environment, leaves vulnerable human data points completely uncalibrated, and then when those individuals inevitably break under systemic pressure and commit an unconscionable act in a state of chaotic survival, what is our institutional response? Do we fix the machine? Do we calibrate the environment? No. We roll out the ultimate lazy bureaucratic ultimatum: conform or die. The death penalty is the absolute peak of this hypocrisy. It's an arbitrary punishment for people who have failed inside a system that never gave them a baseline chance to survive, allowing the state to wash its hands of its own structural failures by destroying the evidence in an execution chamber. Let's pull back the curtain on the physical and chemical reality of how the state executes this ultimatum. We need to look directly at the mechanics before a single administrative error occurs, because society loves to use white sheets and IV stands to pretend this is a sterile, quiet medical procedure. It isn't. It's a forced, violent chemical assault on the human matrix. Look at the standard three-drug lethal injection assay. Let's analyze the actual bench science of what is happening inside the vascular matrix. You start with an anesthetic, usually a massive dose of sodium thiopental or midazolam. In a medical setting, this is used to induce a chemical coma so the patient feels nothing. But on an execution table, this is the most unstable step in the entire assay. Midazolam is a lipophilic sedative, not an analgesic. It does not stop pain. Under a high adrenaline crisis spike, the drug reaches a ceiling effect, failing to fully saturate the central nervous system's receptors. If the dosage is miscalculated or if the venous access is compromised, the inmate remains chemically conscious and fully capable of processing nociceptive pain signals for what comes next. What next is the paralytic, pancuronium bromide. This is a neuromuscular blocker that binds to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, completely paralyzing the entire voluntary muscle system. It stops the diaphragm, effectively suffocating the input. But let's be explicit about the aesthetic design here. This drug does not stop pain. It stops movement. It ensures that the inmate cannot cry out, thrash, or grimace. It's a chemical curtain drawn to protect the audience behind the glass from seeing the physical reality of the execution. Finally, you introduce potassium chloride. In a clinical lab, we know potassium balances the cell membrane potential via the sodium-potassium pump. Pumping a massive bolus of concentrated potassium chloride into a vein completely shatters that electrolyte equilibrium. It floods the cardiac muscle cells, preventing them from repolarizing, which instantly stops the heart in a state of permanent contraction. But before cardiac arrest occurs, that concentrated solution causes excruciating, widespread chemical burning as it tears through the vascular walls. If the first drug failed to keep the inmate deeply unconscious, the paralytic ensures they are completely trapped inside a frozen, silent body while they feel themselves burning alive from the inside out. Because major global pharmaceutical corporations have completely barred their life-saving medications from being used for state-sanctioned killings, departments of corrections have been forced to act as rogue compounding pharmacies. They buy unregulated gray market chemicals and test experimental drug combinations on human subjects. Furthermore, this volatile chemistry is not handled by high-level clinical practitioners. The American Medical Association explicitly forbids members from participating because it violates the Hippocratic Oath. Instead, it is administered by hidden, undertrained correctional staff who routinely struggle with the basic line placement and dosage calculations. When things go wrong, it turns into an absolute administrative panic right there on the table. Think back to the execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma. The execution team spent nearly an hour struggling to find a vein, repeatedly puncturing his tissue before placing an IV line directly into his groin. When the drugs were administered, the vein ruptured, causing the chemicals to saturate his soft tissue instead of his bloodstream. Lockett awoke on the table, writhing and groaning, and it took 43 minutes of agonizing failure before he died of a heart attack while the state frantically tried to call off the execution. We see this exact scenario repeating itself because the system refuses to calibrate its instruments. In early 2024, Idaho was forced to completely halt the execution of Thomas Creech after an execution team made 8 separate failed attempts to insert a peripheral IV line. But while Idaho at least stepped back to review its technical compliance, other jurisdictions have doubled down on the dysfunction. In May of 2026, Tennessee repeated this exact horrific scenario with the botched execution attempt of Tony Carruthers. The state's Department of Corrections had actually implemented a protocol that reduced training requirements for IV placement. They send a physician into the chamber who hadn't successfully placed a central line in over a decade. The team spent over an hour repeatedly puncturing Carruthers more than a dozen times, failing to establish the mandatory backup line, and failing a last resort central line into his chest while he groaned in visible pain on the table. The execution had to be aborted, forcing the governor to issue an emergency one-year reprieve. This isn't a string of isolated incidents. It's not an accident. It is a predictable administrative pattern. The state lacks the basic technical competency to execute its own protocols, yet it keeps pushing bodies into the machine. When lethal injection chemicals fail, or when states choose older backup methods, the mechanical reality becomes overtly violent, stripping away any illusion of clinical neutrality. If a state turns to the electric chair, the protocol requires forcing an automated system to deliver an initial massive jolt, typically around 2,000 volts, designed to force immediate brain death and cardiac arrest. But if the conductivity drops or the voltage fluctuates, the current arcs across the surface rather than penetrating the brain. The machinery literally cooks the internal organs and soft tissue while the heart continues to beat, turning a mechanical execution into a prolonged thermal assault. Even older legacy methods, like hanging, reveal a deeply unstable mechanical reality. Hanging is governed by a precise mathematical calculation known as the drop table, which matches the inmate's physical weight against the exact length of the rope's drop. The goal is to generate just enough kinetic force to instantly fracture the second cervical vertebrae, severing the spinal cord. If the calculation is short, the force is insufficient, and the inmate is left to face a slow, agonizing strangulation. If the drop calculation is too long, the kinetic energy overcorrects, and the force completely decapitates the body on the rope. This brings us directly to the constitutional friction of the Eighth Amendment, which explicitly bars cruel and unusual punishments. The courts have created a bizarre paradox. They have ruled that the Constitution does not guarantee a painless death, but by trying to medicalize the process to appear decent, the state has built an erratic, volatile mechanism that cannot guarantee a standard, non-cruel output. The punishment is inherently cruel because its physical administration is completely unstable. When we run the final quality control numbers on this machine, the telemetry is damning. Let's talk about the raw statistics of failure that the state tries to bury. First, let's look at the failure of selection. Since 1973, over 200 individuals have been completely exonerated and released from death row after being wrongfully convicted. According to rigorous legal and statistical assessments, the conservative estimated rate of innocence for individuals sentenced to death in America is 4.1%. So let's apply my background directly here. If a diagnostic instrument on a hospital lab bench carried a 4.1% catastrophic error rate, if it gave a lethal diagnosis or cleared a critical sample incorrectly 4 times out of every 100 runs, you would instantly pull it from service and throw it in the biohazard bin. You would call it a threat to public safety. Yet, we accept that exact failure rate from our legal machine when the output is an irreversible human life. Why is the error rate so high? Partly, it's because the initial data input into the system is deeply contaminated by unvalidated junk science. For decades, the courts have accepted subjective impression disciplines like microscopic hair comparison and forensic odontology or bite mark analysis. Unlike DNA profile frequencies, which rely on hard, quantifiable statistical probability matrices, bite marks and hair comparisons carry no verified statistical baseline. Look at the case of Kennedy Brewer, who was wrongfully convicted of murder based entirely on the testimony of a forensic dentist who claimed bite marks on the victim's body explicitly matched Brewer's teeth. DNA testing later completely debunked the testimony, proving the marks weren't even human bite marks, but rather artifacts left by insects in the water where the body was found. The legal system routinely treats subjective speculation as quantitative scientific metrics, introducing analytical artifacts into the data pool long before the trial even concludes. It's an unstable foundation. Second, we have to look at the failure of administration. Out of all of the modern execution methods, lethal injection is statistically the most fragile, carrying a historical 7% botch rate due to ruptured veins, chemical instability, or operator incompetence right there at the table. And that brings us to the baseline question that the state loves to avoid. Is this unstable machine truly about public safety? Or is it even a functional punishment for irredeemable crimes? Let's look at the statistics over the last 50 years. When society demands a lethal pipeline, the cultural justification is almost always the ultimate threat. We are told we need an execution chamber for the rare predatory anomalies, the true monsters who are biologically uncalibrated for human survival. We are told it is for the Ted Bundys, the John Wayne Gacys, the Israel Keyses, or the Jeffrey Dahmers of the world. Fair enough, right? But let's look at the actual forensic data of how the system handled those exact four names. Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy were indeed executed by the state. Good riddance. But Jeffrey Dahmer? He was never even sentenced to death because his crimes occurred in Wisconsin, a jurisdiction that abolished the death penalty back in 1853. The legal machine was completely paralyzed by a state statutory line, sentencing him to consecutive life terms until another inmate terminated his sentence in a gymnasium. And Israel Keyes? In his case, the system never even reached a verdict. He took his own life in a federal holding cell in Alaska before the sentencing matrix could even run its programming. Let's look at the broader data set of the last half century. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, who confessed to murdering 49 women, dodged the execution chamber entirely by trading data for consecutive life sentences. Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, couldn't be sentenced to die because Kansas lacked a valid capital statute when his active crimes occurred. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, was sentenced to death in California in 1989, but the state's timeline is so bogged down by administrative gridlock that he sat in an appellate loop for 23 years until natural biological death claimed him on death row. It paints quite the picture of systemic failure. The death penalty is wrapped in the theater of protecting us from the worst of the worst, yet the majority of these high-profile apex predators have either evaded the sentence entirely through a geographic lottery, use of the bureaucracy to bargain for their lives or simply died of old age while the paperwork churned. The machine does not stop the monsters. It is vastly over-engineered, massively expensive, and completely inefficient at processing the very anomalies for which it claims to exist. So, if the system isn't executing the irredeemable, who's the processing? The answer is as cold as it is predictable. The execution chamber is not a precision instrument designed for the worst of the worst. It's an industrial incinerator for the people who lack the structural, social, and financial leverage to escape it. The machine processes the isolated, the broken, and the poor. Look at the wealth filter. Capital cases require massive financial inputs, independent forensic experts, specialized private investigators, and dedicated legal teams who can audit the state's evidence piece by piece. But the vast majority of capital defendants cannot afford a huge private defense team. They are forced to rely on overworked, underfunded public defender offices, where single attorneys are drowning under staggering caseloads and completely starved of the investigative budgets required to challenge a state prosecution. If two people are wrongfully convicted on the exact same flawed data, but one has a family with the financial capital to hire independent laboratory testing, and the other is completely destitute, the system executes the isolated individual while the other gets a press conference. The scale often does not weigh the severity of the crime, it weighs the depths of the defendant's pockets. And this economic divide ties directly into the systemic failure of equal application across demographic lines. The data shows that the system actively processes the race of the victim as a primary metric. In the United States, an offender is significantly more likely to receive a death sentence if the victim was white and the suspect was not, with statistical models showing the death penalty is pursued at a rate of up to three or four times higher than in cases involving minority victims. This economic filter is deeply contaminated by these variables long before the trial even begins, while paternalistic cultural narratives simultaneously insulate female defendants from the chair. Eileen Wuornos is so well known primarily because she was batting above her perceived social class and showed no remorse. This proves that the subjective societal theater, rather than an objective, even-handed law, governs the final output. You cannot have an equal application of an irreversible punishment when the inputs, wealth, race, and gender are fundamentally unequal from day one. Ultimately, the final outcome of a capital case is most often reduced to a volatile GPS coordinate. We like to talk about the supreme law of the land, but the reality, capital punishment in America is a patchwork map of regional politics. Right now, there are 27 states where the death penalty is technically on the books, and 23 where it is entirely dismantled. Look at the Pacific Northwest. In Oregon, there has been a strict gubernatorial moratorium on execution since 2011. And the state's death row was completely cleared and dismantled because the state decided the system was too broken and carried too much liability to run. But when you drive just a short distance across the state line into Idaho, you're standing in a jurisdiction that actively maintains its execution pipeline And recently reauthorized the firing squad as a backup method because they struggled to source lethal injection drugs. How do we reconcile that? It's the ultimate punishment is an objective moral necessity for the worst of the worst. How can it be essential in Boise but considered a broken liability in Salem? The crime doesn't change. The human damage doesn't change. The only thing that changes is the local political climate. If you're 30 miles on one side of an arbitrary state line, you live in a cell. 30 miles on the other side, you die by the needle or the firing squad. In each case, the choice to pursue an execution isn't made by a neutral computer program or a written standard. It is ultimately made by a district attorney, almost always an elected official. Capital trials are massive political theater. A prosecutor running for re-election in a conservative county has a massive professional incentive to seek a death warrant to look tough on crime, while a prosecutor in a neighboring county might opt for life without parole simply to save the taxpayers millions of dollars in appellate court costs. The final data entry is left to 12 random citizens whose worldview is entirely shaped by their local zip code. To seal the logical argument, we have to look at the fiscal and social telemetry, starting with the financial data. Mainstream death penalty advocates often argue from a place of fiscal frustration, believing that executing someone is cheaper than paying to feed and house them for 50 years. The raw math completely dismantles this error. Because of the mandatory, hyper-complex constitutional checks required in capital cases, a death penalty case costs taxpayers significantly more than a sentence of life without parole. The state is burning millions of public dollars per case just to maintain a system that carries a 4.1% error rate. Furthermore, decades of criminological data show zero statistical correlation between the presence of the death penalty and lower homicide rates. It does not deter the especially heinous, anomalous inputs because those individuals do not perform a rational cost-benefit analysis before offending. Then we have to consider the secondary trauma. When the state runs an execution, it forces human operators to carry out the, frankly, retaliatory violence. Look at the documented psychological trauma carried by prison wardens, correctional officers, and execution teams. Many suffer massive moral injury and PTSD from being forced to act as the human hands of an uncalibrated institutional output. On top of that, because the appellate pipeline takes 20 to 30 years, the victim families are dragged through decades of legal gridlock and media spectacles, continuously resetting their trauma. Life without parole locks the door on day one, ends the legal theater, and allows the healing process to begin immediately, if it can. When we isolate the rare predatory subset, the individuals who are genuinely biologically uncalibrated for human society, capital punishment remains the ultimate recourse of last resort. It is a necessary permanent containment protocol for the true anomalies who have completely broken the social contract. But our current society does not treat this power with the precision or gravity it demands. The capital punishment pipeline doesn't fail because the concept itself is inherently invalid. It fails because a lazy, broken bureaucracy has turned a solemn necessity into an act of punitive belligerence. The state has built an over-engineered theater that starves people of the structural stability to survive, delivers a lazy conform-or-die ultimatum, and then uses an irreversible bias lottery to bury its own systemic failures under the guise of the law. When a machine carries a 4.1% innocence error rate, botches 7% of its physical operations, selects its targets based on wealth and race, and calibrates its results based on a GPS coordinate, it isn't justice. It's an uncalibrated lottery. And giving a lazy bureaucracy the unchecked power to run a lethal lottery is the ultimate systemic failure. The ultimate verdict here is not to call for blanket sentimentality or a complete abandonment of ultimate recourse. The data doesn't demand that we eliminate the tool. It demands that we completely dismantle and reform the broken bureaucracy wielding it. True balance requires an unbending, calibrated system, one that enforces strict environmental discipline and provides robust rehabilitation tools for those who can be reached, while maintaining the absolute precision necessary to isolate and permanently eliminate the true biological anomalies who cannot. Until the state stops using capital punishment as a lazy, politically driven cover for its own systemic failures, the execution chamber remains an uncalibrated hazard to our collective social contract. So, if this analytical deep dive challenged or even reaffirmed the way you look at the mechanics of our justice system, please take a moment to rate and review The Science of Murder on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. It takes less than a minute, and it significantly helps the algorithm push these unconventional conversations to more curious minds. And if you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show. So I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.